Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
My name is Kevin Thompson, formerly of Fort Smith, Arkansas, about to be from Sacramento, California, and that sounds absolutely ridiculous if you want to know the truth. What an honor it has been to be with your people. This past weekend, we had a tremendously good time down in Sugar Land, and I just want to compliment Mark Barnhill and Susan. It's been such a joy to get to know them and who they are. I wouldn't clap for him, but... But what an honor it's been, just how kind he has been in so many ways. And then to get to know your pastor, James, and his wife, Wendy, has been a tremendous, I hope you love your pastor. I'd clap for him. This has been a challenging couple of years in the pastorate. And so I have no doubt that your pastor has in all likelihood heard criticisms that maybe he's never heard before. But I hope that you're loving him in a powerful and a good way. Pastors are leaving left and right. I am one, actually. I'm no longer going to be a lead pastor because it's been very, very difficult. And so, but to have a man who loves the Lord and who loves people. I've seen already that he loves people as well. Appreciate him. I mean, the fact that he's an Aggie is a whole different story, but that's just a whole different thing. Arkansas guys really don't like to be around Aggies during football season, and so that's been hard to take, but baseball and basketball are coming, and so we'll be good to go. But this past weekend, I had the chance to be down in Sugar Land and talk with some of your people about the concept of marriage. And right out those doors, there is a book table, and I have a couple of my books that if you're interested in them, my wife, Jenny, who is here with me, will be back at the book table. I have a book on the Beatitudes as they relate to marriage. And so if you're looking for a fall study to study scripture and then also think about things about marriage, you'll have this. And then I also have a book that I'm going to kind of talk about a little bit today called Fearless Families that just kind of tells our experience of having a child with anxiety and then being a person of anxiety as well. But my wife, Jenny, is with us here today. Today is her birthday. I do nothing but the best for my wife on her birthday. The time hop came up today, and 9 years ago today, we were in Maui. 4 years ago today, we were in Montana, and today, we're at Woodridge. And so, I mean, nothing but the best. My mom has a trick that because of my mom's age, she will switch the numbers of her birthday. My mom just turned 75, so she tells people that she's 57, so she doesn't actually tell her age. So I'll do that with Jenny today, and so if you're smart, you can figure out her age. She's 44. And so switch those right around if you can deduce what's going on there. We have two children back in Arkansas who are currently probably in church enjoying the sermon because they're not having to listen to me at this moment. 16-year-old Ella, who has Down syndrome, and then 13-year-old, her little brother Silas, who is just as crazy as any 13-year-old boy can be. But they grew up just a quarter mile down from their elementary school. And so several years ago, I would always walk them to school, take them by the hands and walk them to school. And so they finally got into sixth grade and fourth grade, and Ella loves to hold my hand, and we're walking to school, and Silas is holding my hand, and we get to the very edge of the property, and Silas lets go of me and runs forward and tries to separate himself as best as he possibly can. And Ella grabs my hand even tighter and says, "That's okay, Daddy. He just wants to be somebody." I thought, Well, don't we all, right? Well, one of those mornings, I went to get them to take them to school, and as I went, and Ella was at the back door, and I yelled for Silas, and he didn't come, and I figured he had lost something, looking for homework, looking for his backpack, a shoe, whatever it is that he was looking for. In the moment, I couldn't find him, so I finally went and searched, and searched all over and couldn't figure out where he was until finally I found this little cubby, and there he was, and as I looked at him, I could tell there was panic all over his face, and something was going on. And I thought in the moment that it was just maybe he had done something wrong or maybe something was happening, but he just absolutely refused to go to school. I rushed Ella down to school and I came back home and he was just in a state I'd never seen him before. And 18 months later, we were in a psychologist's office and she was giving an official diagnosis of what was taking place in his life. This seemingly perfect little boy, bright, funny, sarcastic, obedient, loving, kind. I was thumbing through a document in which she began to explain a little bit of a learning disability that was creating a tension in school, But beyond that, just an overall sense of anxiety. Some of it seasonal, but some of it just an aspect of who he was. And I took that document home, and I went across the driveway where my mom lives, who was a teacher for 40 years, and I handed her the document, and I said, hey, help me understand this. What do you think from a school perspective? Having gone 18 months with school being a struggle, not being able to get in there, him making straight A's, being loved by everybody, not bullied in any way, teachers loved him, and yet being unable to get him to school. I handed this document to my mom and said, tell me what you think. She read it. She thought briefly, and she said, this explains so much about you. I said, what? She said, I never understood why your handwriting was the way it was. I thought it was laziness, but I bet you it's this. The anxiety that you had, the tension you had growing up about going to school, the great grades that you made, and how everybody, you loved everybody, but there was a tension that was there. And in that moment that we got a diagnosis, it didn't give us a pathway forward, but it gave us an explanation of what was going on. But that explanation didn't tell us what to do. The turning point for me and Jenny actually came not in an office of a doctor, but actually in our living room, where Silas was going through a very difficult day, and we're struggling trying to figure out how do you parent in the midst of this moment. And in the midst of the confusion and the tension that was taking place, Jenny looked at him very strongly, lovingly, and yet sternly said, Silas, I know you're afraid right now, and it's okay to be afraid right now, but I am not going to allow your fear to dictate what we do. We are going to love you to the best of our ability. And that was it. That was the pathway. That was the lens through which we were then going to view everything. And here we are now 3 or 4 years later, and Silas is now, not in the summer, but Silas this past year attended school well, is adjusting well, is dealing with a learning disability, and that was the lens through which our entire family changed, that we need to be driven by love in everything that we do. And that's not a new concept. We see that in John chapter 13, which is where we're going to be today. If you have your Bibles, I hope you do. You can turn there in John chapter 13. If you don't have them, I'm sure it's a verse you've heard before and can understand. And so in chapter 13, the text takes a dramatic shift in which Jesus and the disciples are in the upper room, and Jesus grabs the towel and kind of interrupts the dinner that is going on, and he begins to wash the feet of the disciples. And the disciples don't understand what is taking place in this moment. They're beginning to object. How can our master begin to serve us? And so Peter says, you know, you're not going to wash any part of me. And Jesus says, hey, if I don't wash you, you're not going to enter into the kingdom. And then Peter, being Peter, goes, then wash all of me. And Jesus is like, come on, Pete, just do what I tell you to do here. Let me wash your feet. And he washes his feet. And all this stuff is taking place. The disciples are trying to take it all in of what is going on in the moment. And then Jesus says, one of you is going to betray me. And everybody begins to look around trying to figure out, is it me? Surely I'm not going to betray him. And who is it? What's going on? They're all kind of reclining around the table. And Peter makes eyes at John because John is right next to Jesus. And Peter goes basically, hey, ask him who it's going to be. And John kind of leans over and says, Lord, who's it going to be? And Jesus, for whatever reason, whispers back and says, it's going to be the one that dips the bread in the cup. And they pass the cup and Judas doesn't. Oh my goodness, we now know who it is. And Judas leaves the room at the command of Jesus. And then the text says that it's at that point, interesting that it's at that point, not before, that Jesus then gives a new command. You know what it is. John chapter 13, verse number 34. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Now, what's new about that? You can take that all the way back to Leviticus. That we're supposed to love our neighbor. What's new about that? A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you are also to love one another. Just as I have loved you. The new aspect of that command in that moment is not the concept of love. It's the definition of love. It's the exhibition of love. Jesus, having just washed the disciples' feet, illustrated for them what love was all about. He was about to fully illustrate it for them as he hung on the cross and paid the penalty for their sins. And then he goes on to tell them, now I want you to love others the way that I have loved you. And that's a process, that's a task now of, in my opinion, what it means to be a follower of Jesus. To be a follower of Jesus is someone who is learning to be loved and to love. That's the task. To be loved by God, to recognize that love, to receive that love, to see our need for that love, our inability to earn or deserve that love in any way whatsoever, and to receive it from God, and then to begin to return that love back to Him. But it doesn't stop there. Then we are challenged to take that love and to pour it out to other people. And the very first context that He places that command is not to the person outside these walls, but actually ultimately what would be the person inside these walls. To the disciples, He says, learn to love one another. And He goes on to say that by this they will know that you are My disciples in your love for each other. And I think very easily we can take a biblical overview and begin to say that God has created two classrooms in which we are to learn to love each other. And in that training ground of learning to love each other, to be loved and to love, we can then take that love to the world. But apart from these two classrooms, we will greatly struggle to live this out to the extent that Jesus calls us to live it out. We might love those who are like us. We might love those who vote like us. We might love those who cheer for the same team as us. We might love those who are easy to love. But to truly love everybody, to truly put the needs of others before ourselves, to truly love those who are different than us, that takes a training, a classroom. And I believe that God created intentionally two classrooms for this to take place. The first is the church. The disciples here would eventually plant the church. And the first is the church. That this is supposed to be a mixed up group of people that are difficult to love. And yet because of the commands of Christ, we are learning to serve and love one another, to be loved by God, and then to give love to one another and to receive it from each other. And in so doing, we will learn to love people who are different than us, who make mistakes, who fail us, who do tremendous things against us, and we will learn what it means to love like Jesus. And then the second one is the home. All the way back into the garden, before sin entered the world, God created the family, and He has intentionally placed us inside of families. And the very foundation of family is marriage. And then it ripples out into children and to extended families as well. And I think the intention of marriage is to learn how to be loved and to love. That those don't come naturally to us. Now we understand our struggle to love. We understand that we struggle to forgive others. We struggle to put others' needs in front of ourselves. We understand that. But we often don't understand that we also struggle to be loved. I'll never forget my grandmother. She was 90. She was in the hospital dying of cancer. This is the toughest woman I've ever met in my life. I mean, born in the middle of Arkansas in the 20s, just she literally had hands of steel. She would make biscuits in the iron skillet and stick it in the oven and pull it out without a pot holder. It made no sense to me whatsoever. No sense. And she's in the hospital, and it's just me and her in that moment. We had a great relationship because I'm a favorite grandchild. And so we had this great relationship. And when she looked at me, she goes, "Kevin, this is so hard." I said, "Oh, Mama, I know. I can only imagine what it's like to see your life come to an end." And she goes, "No, it's not that. Dying's not hard." She said, "It's so hard to let them walk around and serve me all the time." She didn't like the nurses. She felt like she should be doing it all on her own because of her entire life, that's all she had ever done. And I said, "Mamaw, this is a time where you have to be served, not serve." And she couldn't take it. Her struggle in that moment was to actually receive love. One thing that we don't know about ourselves is that we struggle to receive love. To actually be given grace by somebody else, to be forgiven by our spouse, to recognize our own need for those things and to actually receive them and to take them, not to earn them in some way, but to actually receive them for the gift in which they are. That's a struggle. And God has given us these two classrooms in which we can learn in this church. That to the same extent that when somebody has a death in their family, you might take a casserole to them, you have to be able to receive it from them as well whenever there's a sorrow and loss in your family. In the same way that you are quick to forgive somebody else whenever they offend you, you have to be willing to receive that forgiveness whenever you offend them and go and seek to apologize to them. And as we do that, as we learn and create a loving community where we're learning to be loved by God and to love Him in return, to love one another and to be loved in return, as we do that, there will be something special and unique that we're set apart different from everybody else. And the same is true in the family. That Jenny and I, our task is to learn to love and be loved. And she loves me in a way that I can't even begin to comprehend. An affection for me, a stability, a commitment that is there, even though she knows my flaws more than anybody else. And I love her in such a way that at every moment I'm trying to not only receive that from her, but to give love back to her. And yet, left to our own devices, we will not love. There is an enemy that stands between us loving God and loving one another. And I think biblically speaking, that enemy is fear. The most common repeated command in all of Scripture is fear not. The very first words of Jesus recorded in Matthew after His resurrection was, "Greetings, do not be afraid." Now, I think left to its own devices there, we'd think, well, of course, he has to say, do not be afraid. To these women in this dark morning in some ways, they're seeing a resurrected Jesus. It was a scary moment. But the fact that that phrase is repeated somewhere between 365 and 385 times all throughout Scripture says God is trying to communicate something to us that maybe we don't know about ourselves. And that is that fear owns us. It owns us. And you and I cannot fear and love at the same time. You can't make a choice based on love and a choice based on fear at the exact same time. You will choose one or the other. And what I found in my experience with our son is we were dealing with anxiety, that his anxiety was creating anxiety within me, and suddenly our home was becoming so anxious, our marriage was becoming tense, everything was becoming so anxious, and anxiety creates anxiety, which creates anxiety, to where every decision we were making was being based on the concept of fear. We were afraid of what might happen, and so we began to kind of idolize some things that shouldn't be idolized. And as I begin to look at who we are and how we were living and comparing that to the invitation that Jesus was giving to us, I just created a very simple drawing. It's in the book Fearless Families. It's a very simple drawing. It's just two houses. And I'm a simple artist because I'm not an artist at all. But remember in third grade how they would teach you to draw a house? You draw a floor, two walls, and then a roof. This is about the same time you were learning, here's the church, here's the steeple, open the doors and see all the people, right? It's about the same skill level that I have there. And so I just drew a floor, two walls, and a roof. And I put fear in the center. And I said, okay, when fear drives us, what builds the home of the afraid? What does the church of the afraid look like? What does the marriage of the afraid look like? What are the things that we value? And I begin to notice that when fear drives us, we build our lives on the foundation of safety. Is it safe? And safety is a good thing. We have to be concerned with safety. We have to think about safety. As a husband, I have to consider the safety of my wife. As a father, I have to consider the safety of my children. As a pastor, I have to consider when somebody's going on a mission trip, is that safe? How can we make it safe? This morning, I guarantee you there's been choices made to ensure your safety in this moment. Safety in and of itself is a good thing. But as Tim Keller would say, whenever we take a good thing and make it a God thing, that becomes an idol. And when safety becomes the ultimate question, instead of just a question, we begin to put it in the place of God. Do you notice that Jesus never asked the question, is it safe? As a matter of fact, he would often send his disciples into very dangerous situations. And yet he never said, is it safe? He asked questions of, is it loving? Is it good? Is it right? Is it true? Is it noble? Is it pure? But not, is it safe? And yet for many of us in the church, in the family, we have so idolized safety that we have now equated safety with the will of God, we would think that God would never call us to do something dangerous. And yet he might call us to the mission field. Doesn't mean it's going to be safe. He might call us to witness to a coworker. Doesn't mean it's going to be safe. And we have literally built our lives on the foundation of safety. And whenever you and I do that, when safety is our foundation, a very natural roof appears. It's the roof of appearances. Fear causes us to be more concerned with the image that we project than who we actually are. And nothing gives us the feeling of safety quite like the idea of projecting a strength, a power, an idea that we have it all together. And when fear drives us, we value appearances. Now, appearances can matter. Your name matters. But it's not an ultimate thing. And yet for many of us, we have made it into the ultimate thing. And when safety is the foundation and appearances is the roof, two very natural walls begin to appear. That of materialism and power. We are meant to live outside of ourselves, to connect with other things, and yet people are dangerous to us. And when fear drives us, we can't get close to others because of what they might do to us. And so we try to find connection with material things. A new car will not stab you in the back. A new house will not hurt your feelings. And it gives you the sense of something beyond yourself. And when fear drives us, power becomes the ultimate. Because we think to ourselves that if we can just hold on to the power, that maybe our fears will begin to lessen. And the home of the afraid is defined by safety and appearances and materialism and power. And I see that in marriages. I see that with families. I see that in churches. Churches who preach nothing but the idea of eternal security, which is important, but there's no sense of discipleship whatsoever. It's get as many people walking down the aisle and baptized as quickly as possible, and that will give them safety for heaven, safety against hell, but we don't have to disciple them in any way whatsoever. I see some churches who are just built around appearances. You just have to keep up the idea of a righteousness. This is the Pharisees and the Sadducees. You just have to promote an external righteousness as though you have it all together, no matter how far your heart is from God. You see a health and wealth prosperity gospel that's just proclaiming the idea of materialism. It's nothing but fear being baptized in some way. You see many who preach a gospel of power. And the idea that politics is our ultimate salvation because if we don't have the power, somebody else might have it, and what's going to happen to us? It's just fear. It's not the gospel. And yet Jesus offers us a different way. When he says, love one another as I have loved you, what he's saying in that moment is don't allow fear to drive you. You can feel it. You can experience it. But don't allow fear to be the driving force. Instead, make every choice and decision out of love. And whenever you do that, you will create a different home. You'll create a different church. Looks the same, but built with different materials. The foundation of the home of what I would call the home of the brave, because love takes courage. The foundation of the home of the brave, or the home of love, is not safety, it's trust. That I trust God, and I'm learning to trust others. That Jenny and I are learning to trust one another, which means we have to live in a trustworthy manner, but it also means that I have to trust her, who she's going to be, that she's going to live up to her vows, that I'm going to live up to my vows. Our kids are learning to trust us. We are learning to build them into people that we can trust as well. And while safety is important, ultimately I'm saying, God, I put my life into your hands. I trust you. That's the foundation upon which I'm going to build my life. That whatever takes place in your sovereign control, in your providential work, I trust you. And whenever trust is the foundation of your life, the roof that you lean on is not that of appearances, for appearances don't matter so much. It is now the roof of heart, of character. That I am far more concerned with what's actually going on and who I actually am than what you think about me. That we are far more concerned with the very heart of this church, whether or not we actually love Jesus, whether or not we're actually following Jesus, than what some outsiders might believe. And when you and I begin to trust God and begin to trust each other, we can actually take our heart and put them on the table and say, here's who I am, now change me, God. But when fear is driving us and we're built on the foundation of safety, we will so lean on appearances that we will hide all the bad parts of us, all the dirty parts of us. We will only give people the good parts that we think are worthy of being loved, and we will never experience any transformation whatsoever because we will never give God our true hearts. But when we build our lives on the foundation of trust, and the roof that we find shelter under is the roof of heart, above all else, guard your heart. The wisdom writer will say, do you care more about the appearance of your marriage or the heart of your marriage? Do you care more about training your child in the way he or she should go, or in how your friends think you're parenting in the moment? Do you care more about how this church looks and feels, or about the actual transformation of lives? And when you and I build our lives and these churches and our homes on the foundation of trust, underneath the roof of heart, two natural walls begin to appear, that of relationship and submission. Rather than materialism, we seek relationship. Rather than looking for life beyond ourselves and material things, we look for life beyond ourselves to connect with other people. We recognize our need for other people, but the danger in that is that we know as we reach out to other people, they're going to disappoint us, they're going to hurt us. It's going to be frustrating in some way. But because we trust God, because we're putting our whole hearts out on the table and we're hoping they will as well, because we're driven by love, we will recognize our need to connect with other people and we will begin to value relationship, which then empowers us to value submission, not power, but instead to begin to model the life that Jesus lived in Philippians chapter 2, who did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, that power something to be held onto, but instead he emptied himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. He submitted to his Father's will, knowing that that was the better way. And so in church, we begin to learn submission. Submission to leadership, submission to one another. In marriage, we begin to learn submission. I submit to Jenny, Jenny submits to me. And we begin to find out that as scary as submission is, it is a better way of life. That it is the way of love in that moment. I wonder today, which home are you creating? What about this church? Are you being driven by fear? In a post-COVID world and in a secular society and the darkness that is coming and all the political upheaval and the racial tensions and everything that's taking place, is fear driving you to where you're valuing safety, you're valuing appearances and materialism and power, and those are the things you are proclaiming? Or have you taken the contrarian way of Jesus and gone the way of love? It's where you're just learning to trust him in the midst of all things, to put your whole heart out on the table before God and even before others, learning to connect with others who don't even look like you and sometimes you don't even like, but you're learning to love, and learning to submit first and foremost to his will, but then also to other people. What kind of marriage do you have? Are you learning what it means to be loved and to love and transferring more and more from the home of the afraid into the home of the brave? What kind of home are your kids being raised in? Are they actually being trained in fear? That your first question is always that of safety. It's always that about what other people are going to think. That the way you motivate them is through material things, training them that this is really the good stuff of life. Now holding over them the power that you have over them, thinking to yourself that this will keep them safe, but in reality just training them that whoever has the power gets the final say. Are you exhibiting for them a home of the brave where love drives everything? And in the same way that you're trying to learn to trust God and trust others, you're trying to help them trust God and trust others. And you're training them that it's all about the heart, not these outward appearances. And it's relationship and submission that's going to literally lead to the flourishing that it is that you desire. Which home do you have? I want to close with a very simple test. I think there's one way that you can look at these two things and say which is driving you. For Jesus calls us to love one another as he has loved us. And when love is present in our lives, it has a byproduct. It's that of gratitude. Fear never has that. Fear-filled people are never full of gratitude, but love gives us gratitude. Now, I want to tell you a story that in all likelihood happened 21 years ago today. I had lived in Phoenix, Arizona for a summer working at a church, and as I was there, I began to play golf with a CEO who was there. And so I played college golf, and so he had never been around somebody who could break 100, and so he was impressed, right? And so one day I'm at the office and he says, hey, can you plan a golf tournament on Thursday? And I said, sure, I'd be happy to. He said, all right, it's in Philadelphia. And I said, what? He said, yeah, it's in Philadelphia. I'm going to fly you to Philadelphia. He said, every year for the last 10 years, I've gotten last in the Auntie Anne's corporate golf tournament, and that's going to change because I just hired you as my chaplain. And I said, okay. And so we flew to Philadelphia. I ate more pretzels than you can ever even begin to imagine. I mean, literally by the fourth hole, I wanted to throw up. And then by the eighth hole, I'm like, hey, a pretzel, let's eat another one. And so we won the golf tournament. He was as happy as could be. Everybody there was skeptical. All these people were coming up to me, asking me questions. When did you start working there? What do you know about plastics? Do you even know the name of the company, right? And so, but we won. And so a year later, I had moved to Birmingham, Alabama, and that's where I was going to graduate school, and Jenny had moved there as well. We were soon to get married, and Ray called me up again. He said, hey, Kevin, hey, can you play in the corporate golf tournament again? And I said, sure, it's summertime, I'm not in school, everything's going great, and he gave me the date, and I said, yeah, that'll be great, no problem. And I hung up, and then I got to thinking, man, that date sounds familiar. What is that date? And then it hit me. That's Jenny's birthday. And so I called Ray back and I said, hey, tell me again when we're leaving. And he said, all right, we're leaving on this date. We will get back there on the night of the 18th. And I'm like, okay, let me ask her. Okay, I'd never written a marriage book at this point, right? And so I called Jenny up at work and I said, hey, Jenny, do you mind if I go play this golf tournament? I mean, it's your birthday. If you don't want me to go, I won't go. And we've always had the policy of we don't read between the lines. Whatever you say, that's I'm going to take you. So you can't say, oh, sure, you can go if you dare. It's not one of those kind of things, right? And so she said, she's never been a big person on specific dates. She said, hey, just see if you can catch a flight home and you can take me to dinner that night. You'll have a great golf tournament. I'll get to celebrate my birthday. It'll be great. Okay, so I called Ray. Everything was going to go exactly as planned. Flew up to Philadelphia. We repeated as champions again. I have been at the company now for 2 years. I began to get a bonus because of my work and time and effort that was played out there, right? And so we drove back to the airport, and I was going to fly from Philadelphia to Newark and from Newark down to Atlanta because the travel agent didn't have a globe, and then I was going to drive home to Birmingham, right? So we flew out of Philadelphia. I get into Newark, and whenever I get into Newark, fog sets in. And my flight gets canceled. And the airport is crazy, and they begin to explain that I'm going to be on the first flight the next day. There were a couple more flights that could get out on, but I was going to be there the next day. And I was panicked. This was before cell phones. I didn't want to call Jenny. I didn't want to disappoint her. I'm trying to get her to marry me. This is the last thing that I need to have happen at this point in life. And so I'm standing along the wall, and finally I think to myself, there's a ticket agent. They're starting to, the fog is lifted, a plane's going out. It's full, but a plane's going out. I think, I bet you I can get on that plane. I'm going to be a pastor. I know how to manipulate people. And so I walked up. I walked up to the ticket agent and I said, hey, ma'am, is there any way I can get on that plane? And she goes, there is no way you're going to get on this plane. And I begin to explain, well, ma'am, I'm on a business trip. I've worked for this plastics company for the last 2 years, and we have been up here for business, and today is my wife or my soon-to-be wife's birthday, and I really want to get home and to see her. Is there any way I can get on this plane? And she goes, baby, you see all those suits over there? They're all going before you. There's no way you're flying out today. I thought, oh no. Dejected, I went back and I just kind of slumped down on the wall. And I thought, I'll call Jenny eventually. I'm just not going to do it right now. Fear was driving me, right? And so they begin to load the plane and everything was good. And a couple of the standby people got on. And the next thing you know, somebody came down the jet bridge and they came up to the ticket agent. The ticket agent leaned to the microphone. This is pre-9/11, right? The ticket agent leaned to the microphone and said, will Kay Thompson please report to the desk? Well, that's me, Kevin Thompson. I run over. She goes, are you Thompson? I said, yes. She says, here's your ticket. I said, okay. And so I run down, I get on the jet bridge, the flight attendant is there, meets me on the plane, says, hurry up, we're about to take off. Here's your seat right here, front row, first class. Oh, it was a different life. I didn't know it existed. They were bringing me slippers and cookies and newspaper. It was absolutely beautiful. I was as happy as could be. We pushed back from the jet. We got on, we took off in the air. I was having the greatest flying experience of my life. Well, the guy next to me apparently was not having a good day. He was in a suit and everything was frustrating him, primarily the passenger who was beside him, who was as happy as could be. And he finally looked over at me and he goes, not fly much? And so I began to explain the story of what actually took place. And he said, that doesn't sound right. He said, can I see your ticket? I think he was trying to get me kicked to the back of the plane. And I said, sure. And he looked at me and he said, well, it looks good to me. And he handed it back to me, and that's when I saw it. Keith Thompson. I'm Kevin Thompson. I don't know what happened to Keith that day. But Kevin Thompson made it home in time for his wife's birthday. You know what amazes me, though, to look back on that? Me and that man were having the exact same experience. We were in the exact same seat, in the exact same plane, going from the exact same location to the exact same destination, having two radically different experiences. What was the difference? I knew I didn't deserve to be there. There was gratitude in my heart for everything. It doesn't mean that everything was perfect, but even the imperfections, I could accept, recognizing all the things that I have been given, I don't deserve to be there. I wonder today, in that seat that you're in, next to the person you're next, in the church that you're in, do you deserve it? Do you deserve it? For if you feel a sense of entitlement, then chances are fear is going to creep in that you might lose it, or that you might miss out on what you actually deserve, what you could get. And you're going to begin to be driven by fear in every way, and it's going to suck all the gratitude out of you. But if in love you recognize that what God has given you is undeserved in every way, loved by God, forgiven, every sin wiped away because of the blood of Jesus, blessed in ways that you can't even begin to imagine. If you allow that and you feel that gratitude, you will be able to choose the way of love over the way of fear, and it will literally make all the difference. Thanks be to God for what He has given to us. And now let us love others the way He has chosen to love us.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.